Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Yeah, it's good to be with you. Australia, of course, is often described as the lucky country, a phrase which is misused hugely, of course. It was meant to be ironic, but still, we think of ourselves as lucky in lots of ways, don't we? We've got great natural resources, we've got lots of gas, which apparently we've sold to everybody else overseas and forgotten about ourselves. We've got good weather. We've got a lot of distance from problems elsewhere in the world. People who come here like the peaceful way of life. Financially, of course, we were relatively untouched by the global financial crisis, whether by luck or good management, probably a combination of both, I suspect, and have been supported by strong demand for resources from China and other Asian nations. Might seem like we're in good stead, but you never know what the future holds, especially when it comes to investing. Now, the age-old saying, of course, is high risk, high reward, but when you look at long-term investments, stocks and bonds and real estate and superannuation, etc., I wonder whether that always holds up. And how does current international uncertainty over markets look at what's happening on the Korean Peninsula, for heaven's sake? Although, surprisingly, markets don't always react in ways you'd predict. Today, the Japanese stock market went up. Now, you'd think, wouldn't you, given their proximity, that there'd be a rush to the door. Wasn't so. David Buckland from Macquarie Investments, from Montgomery Investment Management is here to talk us through market trends and what we should look out for. And if you've got questions, please, the number 1300 800 222, or text on 0467 922 702. David, good evening and welcome to Nightlife.
Thank you very much, Philip.
Yes, it seems like a troubled time internationally, doesn't it?
Oh, it does rather. You know, it doesn't matter if it's...
But gold went down.
It doesn't matter.
Gold went down and the Japanese stock market went up. Come on, explain that. How is that possible?
It's very hard to explain the market in 24 hours.
Yeah, I guess so. Tell us about the returns from the share market over the longer term anyway.
Yeah, okay. So there's these three academics from the London Business School, Dimpson, Marsh and Staunton. What they do is they analyse asset classes going back since 1900. So over the last 116 years, what they've assessed is that first world countries' stock markets have generally delivered a return on average of about 10 percentage points.
Mm-hmm.
Conversely, properties, ungeared properties, done about 7%, and bonds have done less than inflation, which is typically sort of 3 or 3.5%. Now, if you compound that up over, say, 116 years, it's obviously very, very exciting to be compounded up at 10% rather than 7 or 3 or 3.5.
So equities, that's the share market, have done 10.
Yeah.
Property's done 7.
Typically, and bonds and bills have done sort of, you know, 2 or 3 or 3.5, which is typically less than inflation over the last 116 years.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with these numbers, Philip, is that the share market, despite the 10%, and despite being the most exciting place to be over 116 years, also has what we call the most volatility. So it has more ups and more downs and relatively wild swings. So if you happen to be to catch one of those wild swings and invest your hard-earned just before one of those wild swings, you can quickly lose 50%, as we know, and as could, you know, numerous times in the last 116 years.
Yeah, it's all very well. What were the famous words of the English economist John Maynard Keynes? It's all very well to measure things over the long run, but of course, in the long run, we're all dead.
Yeah, that's right.
Almost everyone is interested in the relatively short run, aren't they?
Everyone's very interested in the very short run.
Yeah. And the point you make about property is an interesting one. It's been made before too, that despite our national obsession with investing in property and the recent very high price increases in Sydney and Melbourne, overall, on average, property is about what? Not as good as the stock market.
No, it's about 3% less. But you've got to remember, if you compound up 7 a year for 116 years or 10 a year for 116 years, there's an enormous difference compounding it up over any long period of time.
All right, what should we be wary of though?
Well, I think there's a lot of things. So, for example, in the last three odd decades, we've had probably four factors that have been very, very kind to markets. So one of the major factors has been interest rates. If you go back to the very early 1980s, we had a Fed chairman called Paul Volcker.
Mm-hmm.
And what he wanted to do is he wanted to kill inflation. So he pushed interest rates up immensely. And what happened was long-term interest rates in the States, which was running at about 14 or 15 percentage points, came down very recently to approximately sort of 1.5 percentage points.
Mm-hmm.
And that followed a course in Germany, UK, Japan, Australia, Canada, where they're all roughly 14 or 15%, and they've been as recently as low as 0.1% or 2%, depending on which country you've been in. So when you have a tailwind over the last 3.5 decades like that, then a lot of people mistake genius from a massive tailwind. a second factor I think that's been very kind has been, basically freedom of credit. So in the 1970s, you know, if you want the colour television, you asked Dad for the colour television, he'd say, yeah, wait, son, wait till I've got the cash to pay for it.
Yeah.
Well, that seems, you know, laughable today, where everyone has a bunch of credit cards and is loaded up to the gunnels with debt.
Well, also, things like that don't cost so much anymore. Once upon a time, a television was a major purchase.
Yeah, so we've seen massive deflation in many products. But secondly, as long as you pay on time,
you can have anything.
You've got relatively free cash for 4 or 5 weeks. The problem is if you don't pay on time. But what's happened is because the average country or the average householder or the average government has enormous debt now relative to, say, 3 decades ago, there's a view that we've brought forward consumption. The third factor, Philip, is just demographics. We've obviously seen very, very kind demographics over, you know, really since World War II. And you've got many countries, and Japan's a case in point, where their current population is going from 128 million people to probably 98 million people over the next 4 decades.
Mm.
And so demographics have been very kind for some countries, and they're going to be, you know, they're going to be far less kind. And then the final point is just US corporate profit margins, which has been fairly cyclical since World War II. But in the last 15 years during the tech wreck, they were at all-time lows since World War II, and more recently they're at all-time highs. And there's an inverse relationship between US corporate profit margins and the take on labour. So if labour's doing well, corporations do less well, and if labour's doing relatively poorly, US corporate profit margins do much better. And there's an inverse relationship there.
Mm.
And I think with things like globalisation and digitisation and commoditisation and you know, automation and even artificial intelligence, what's going to happen or what is happening is that corporations generally are doing particularly well, and labour, you know, is basically being sort of smashed, particularly if you're in manufacturing or steel making or
almost,
you know,
anywhere,
textile,
really,
clothing, footwear, sort of old industries. You know, you've been outsourced to Asia or you're under the pump domestically, one way or the other.
Yeah, well, the share of the economy going to wages is low.
Yeah,
historically low.
Correct. Wages growth is extremely low.
And you know, the share going to profit and to capital is higher.
That's right.
And so exactly, if you're a wage earner, of course, you're being screwed.
That's right. So if you're a corporation, you know, you've enjoyed sort of the pulling forward of consumption through indebtedness. You're enjoying very, very low interest rates, like historically low interest rates. We haven't seen interest rates this low ever.
Mm.
You're enjoying, you know, you have enjoyed quite good demographics. And so you've got this situation where companies have done particularly well over the last bunch of decades, and labour generally, as you say, is getting screwed, and so you end up with this sort of massive wealth inequality.
Yeah. Where's it all? I mean, as long as we've had stock markets, we've had doomsayers.
Yeah, I'm not saying
a lot of people are of the opinion that, you know, we're about to have another bust. What do you think?
Well, I don't know, and no one knows.
No one knows. I know no one knows.
But all I know is that statistically we have a down year 1 in 4. That's statistics over the last sort of century odd.
Mm-hmm.
And about every 7 or 8 years we have a bit of a doozy. So that's 20-odd%, I'll call it. We call it a bear market. But probably every 2 or 3 bear markets we get a cracker, which is down 40s or 50s or 60s type numbers. And no one knows when the next downturn comes. We don't know if it's going to be a 10% or a 20% or 30% or a 50%. But we just do know that statistically they happen about every 7 or 8 years.
Hmm. We're still not back, of course, to the high the stock market had at the high point of the GFC, isn't it? We're pushing 6,000, but
yeah,
we're slightly over 6,000, I think, at the time of the crash. We're not back there yet.
But the US has done particularly well, but they've got obviously some world-leading technology businesses and healthcare businesses. Mm. Australia, at the end of the day, is, you know, it has been a bit of a quarry, and you know, there's been you know, the pressure on things like iron ore. We can't overestimate when iron ore goes from $180 a ton down to 30 or 40, back to 90, back to 65. So a lot of our companies are doing it a lot tougher than they were some years ago.
Stephen wants to know: is Telstra yielding 7.5% before franking credits and at $4 a good deal?
My view, Stephen, is do not obsess about dividend yields. Dividend yields are just what a company pays out at a point in time. What's most important, in my humble opinion, is a company growing its earnings? And if a company's growing its earnings solidly over 5 or 10 years, the dividends will grow solidly over 5 or 10 years, and the dividend yield will look after itself. So there's a classic example of, say, 10 or 12 years ago, where we look at, say, something like M2 Telecommunications, where it was a 30-cent share and it was probably paying out about a cent. So it was on a yield of about 3%. And Telstra was on a yield of 5%. Fast forward 12 years, Telstra share price is lower than it was 12 years ago. Its dividend has gone from 28 cents to sort of 31 cents. It's probably going to come under pressure, particularly now TPG is entering the mobile
field. Well, there's more competition in the mobile market. Yeah. I mean, they're all going to tank, aren't they? Surely.
And they are. Yeah. And then conversely, you know, there was M2 Telecommunications, whose earnings grew rapidly through mergers and acquisitions and good management. And its dividends went from, you know, something like 1.25 cents to 30 cents over about a 10-year period, and so if you bought it at 30 cents, you're getting close to a 100% yield on your purchase price. Mm. But there's old Telstra that's gone from 28 cents to 31 cents in its dividend over 10 or 12 years. Its share price has gone south. So my point, Stephen, is please do not obsess about dividend yield at a point in time. Obsess about earnings that are growing from bottom left to top right. And if the earnings grow from bottom left to top right, the dividends will look after themselves.
Okay. What do you think of the medical marijuana shares, like MXC and MMJ, says my texter?
Don't know much about them, but I'd say it's a growth industry.
All right. Darren says, I seem to pay a lot in fees with my super, yet I don't with my high interest savings account. My super would be better off there. Why can't I lock it in long term that way?
Yeah, I think it's about returns, and I think your high interest savings account are probably giving you, what? You know, a 2 or 3% return.
I was going to say you're doing better than that in the market, aren't you?
Yeah, yes. And so the markets over, you know, recent periods of time, particularly globally, have done spectacularly well, and even domestically have done, you know, reasonably well over the last sort of 12 or 18 months. So I think, you know, you've got to look at your fees relative to what you've invested in.
Yes, exactly. I mean, if the fees are no good, Darren, change your fund.
Yeah,
which is relatively easily done. David Buckland is here with us from Montgomery. We're talking international markets. 1-300-800-222 is the number. Yes, Sally. Hi.
Hi. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
So my question, I guess it relates to my long-term future. I've inherited a small flat from my dad.
Yep.
I don't own my own home, and I work in the arts, so I need some more income coming in, and I'm basically deciding whether I should sell the flat or whether I should remortgage it and get pay no interest on the mortgage for 3 years or 5 years. That's my big question. Mm-hmm.
Well, Sally, I can't give you specific advice, but one thing I do know is that a lot of asset classes are, in my humble opinion, sort of insanely priced because interest rates have never, ever been lower. So if you look at, say, the apartment market in Australia at the moment, we're building about 160,000 apartments a year, and our typical build is closer to 50 or 60,000. So there seems to me to be an enormous amount of supply.
Yes.
The second point is that, you know, we've had cranes on the horizon that have been numbering, you know, closer to sort of 600 and 700, and we're now down to sort of 500. So it seems to me that we're just starting to come off the boil in terms of the build. The third thing and the most important thing is that when I was in my 20s and I bought an apartment, I typically paid about 3 times my pre-tax earnings for an apartment in a very good suburb in somewhere like Sydney.
Yep.
My children, who are the same age as when I bought an apartment, for the same apartment would pay about 11 or 12 times their pre-tax salary for the same apartment. So that apartment has gone up from 3 times earnings to about 12 times earnings. Now, how do you justify that fourfold increase relative to median income? The only way you do it is interest rates. So if we get a bit of a shock in terms of unemployment going up, or interest rates going up, or property valuations falling, or anything like that. So very much what happened to Portugal and Italy and Ireland, yep, and Greece and Spain in the last GFC in 2008 or 2009, then I think you'll find that there's a very high probability that some of these apartments will be selling for a lot less in 2 or 3 years' yep, time than they are today. So I wouldn't be going out and sort of gearing them up or taking out loans against them anytime soon if I was, if I was advising you.
Yeah, okay. It's not an apartment. It's actually a ground floor flat in a building, you know, that's it's in a great area. It's walking distance to a shopping centre kind of thing. It's not one of the new modern apartment buildings.
Okay.
It's still an apartment, Sel.
Yeah. Okay. All right. That still qualifies as an apartment. Okay. Yeah. That's
I'm just saying. I think caution is warranted for a few factors. Firstly, massive overbuild. Secondly, interest rates have never been lower. Thirdly, Australian householders have never been more indebted relative to their income. Yeah. And then finally, valuations relative to median income are absolutely off the Richter scale.
Yeah, okay.
And that's both domestically and relative to other markets globally for like size cities. So if you compare cities in like Sydney and Melbourne versus say other like size cities in other Western world countries, we are definitely relative to median income. We are definitely sort of more on the Richter, off the Richter scale than not.
Okay. Okay.
Thanks.
Be conservative. And I certainly wouldn't be buying an apartment. Yeah. If that was my option, but okay.
Be conservative.
Yes. Okay.
Well, I think Roger Montgomery was on the program here a few months ago. Sally was very hard-headed about this. He was very, very negative about the prospects of the apartment market. I mean, he's not the only one, too.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't know. None of us know. But that, I think, David, what you're saying, the indicators aren't good, are they?
No. So maybe I should be looking at selling it and buying a house somewhere where I could afford to.
Well. The other thing you've got to consider, of course, is tax. And, there's no need necessarily just to go and sell an asset if you end up with a big tax bill, because what you're doing is you're turning a dollar into 70 cents just because you end up paying a ScoMo, 30 cents in the dollar or whatever it might be. So that's a major consideration on any sale.
Okay. All right. I have to look into that.
Thanks, Sally.
Thank you.
Good luck with it. 1-300-800-222. Peter says, should I buy or sell Medibank shares?
Hold. No, look, I don't really know. We own them at Montgomery Investment Management, right, and, we quite like them at $2, and I think, our valuation is sort of kind of closer to $3, but, it's just not an easy pick for me, Philip.
Okay. Yes, Carol, hi.
Hi, how are you tonight?
I'm well, Carol.
Excellent. In relation to superannuation, I'm 53 years old. I have had super since I think I was 22 in the work environment.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering whether I can use it towards my mortgage. I'd like to pay off the home and then I guess just use it wisely, perhaps self-invest.
I think it's very difficult to legally and from a regulatory point of view to really get hold of your super and use it for mortgage repayments until you turn 60 years of age.
How old?
60 years of age. But I'd get some advice from a half decent accountant on that matter. But I'm saying just for normal people, it is pretty difficult to get your hands.
How old do you say were Carol? 53.
54. 53. Yep.
Yeah, 53. Yeah, I think from previous advice that we've had on the program here, that's probably under the threshold of when you can easily get access to it.
Yeah, so, and with time, I guess they can always change the 60 to maybe stretch it out more.
Yeah, that's certainly a possibility. And the issue is that when they plugged in the magic number of 60, I think, the average Australian male was sort of dead by about 63. And now the average Australian male is kicking out to, typically sort of closer to 80 or something like that. So that's why they're thinking of pushing these age provisions up somewhat, is just because instead of enjoying ourselves for 2 or 3 years, we seem to be enjoying ourselves for a couple of decades.
Mm.
So when you say to actually seek advice from an accountant or legal advice, I guess we're trying to tap into what provisions or what are the prerequisites or what are the loopholes, perhaps.
Yeah, I think more, try to make your money work hard for you in the most sort of tax efficient way. And, a half decent accountant will be able to sort of advise you.
Okay, well, off to the accountant we go.
Thanks, Carol. Bye-bye. Janet, hello.
Hello, I've got another superannuation. Thank you both for taking the question. When I cut back on my work, I took my first superannuation and I've got an allocated pension from it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm taking redundancy in June and will be taking, I have to take my second superannuation. What I was wondering is, should I put all my eggs in one basket and put the second superannuation with the people who are handling my first one? Or I know I'd pay extra fees if I went the superannuation I've got have got their own advisors as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm worried about one lot of people investing all my money.
Look, if the people that have got your first super, they probably have very good diversification in that they probably have a bunch of domestic stocks, a bunch of high-quality global stocks. They probably have some investments in some high-quality property, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So
they do listen to me. I asked for a conservative approach and they invested quite a high percentage in money. So they do listen to me.
Well, that's good. But what I think is important to point out that is that if you go from, say, provider A to provider B, and provider B gives you pretty much the same portfolio, then that's not diversification at all.
No.
Diversification is only good if provider B is giving you a completely alternate offering. So, for example, if provider A is very focused on domestic shares and provider B is much more focused on global shares, and some of those global shares may run completely not in tandem with the domestic shares. So that gives you some diversification. The risk might still be there, but it gives you some diversification. So what you're seeking is you're seeking to try and get a very good after-tax return over the medium to longer term, but you're also seeking to minimise that risk. And you only do that ultimately through allocating your assets conservatively or whatever it might be, but also diversifying.
I've got a slightly guilty conscience, and as I think about things I should be doing in regard to conservation and climate change and all that sort of thing, but I've never checked where any of my money's gone. For all I know, they could be buying uranium. But, and I was wondering if
they could be investing in the Adani coal mine.
Well, yes, exactly. I know. I thought if I don't look, I won't know. And then I wondered if the second one I could ask for. Is there such as I know ethical investment's not the correct word. Of course, you trust everybody's doing ethically investing. But does anybody specialise in things like climate change?
Yeah, so there's a group called Australian Ethical Investments, and they're originally Canberra-based, and they're quite what I'd call a dark green focus. So they basically try and invest in things that are sort of doing good. The problem with focusing only on things that do good is it doesn't necessarily give you great returns over the longer term. So, for example, some would argue solar and wind might be doing good relative to coal. Many would argue that, but it doesn't necessarily mean that investing in the latest, greatest solar company is necessarily a great money-making venture. And we've, in fact, seen many solar companies in places like Germany and China that have been extremely large propositions that have actually gone bust. So you've got to be careful with this whole ethos. You know, I think you do have a duty to yourself to actually make money first and then to try and do good second.
Yes, I certainly wouldn't take all my money and put it in. But thank you for that advice.
All right, Janet. Thank you. Thanks. Appreciate that. Lyle asks a good question. Well, it's a question I've had a number of conversations about too. He said, given you said international companies recover from the stock market downturns better, would I be better off with a 75% balance in international shares instead of Australian shares for my super fund? This is a question which people ponder, isn't it? They should they be in the international market, or should they just stick with what they know here locally?
Yeah, well, I think home ground advantage, everyone plays to it, Philip. And, you know, it amazed me going to New Zealand, how many New Zealanders stick to New Zealand stocks, or going to Scotland, how many Scots stick to Scottish stocks. But ultimately, with globalisation and the like, you know, there's some wonderful companies that happen to be listed in, you know, America or Hong Kong or Paris, and they're plentiful. And we have relatively scarce, very, very high-quality businesses in Australia. And so it seems to me logical for two reasons. Firstly, the opportunity set is so broad. Secondly, that what's going to happen in Australia is that our super pool is currently about $2 trillion, which is a little bit bigger than our economy, which is about the same size as our share market. And that super pool is going to grow to well over $7 or $8 trillion over the next couple of decades. So it's going to be infinitely bigger than our economy. It's going to grow at about twice the pace of our economy.
It's all going to be chasing somewhere to go.
And obviously it's chasing somewhere to go. So logically, if you have a choice between Company A in Australia or Company B in, I don't know, France, Germany, or the US, and Company B has as good or better prospects, and Company B seems to be selling much more cheaply, then surely that marginal dollar's got to chase Company B rather than the domestic Company A.
The other big factor there, though, is the exchange rate, isn't it? I mean, that's something you can't control.
No, that's right. But if the Australian
that affects things hugely.
But if the Australian dollar is closer to parity than, say, 60 cents, it would be logical for most Australians to get a certain portion of their money offshore by buying global stocks. And as I say, you can buy these wonderful sort of technology network platforms, you know, that may be listed in the States or Hong Kong or whatever, that you just can't get in Australia.
Okay. Jeff says, hi, Phil and David. Any thoughts on Slater and Gordon? I've lost a fortune and I'm inclined to hold on. Do you think this firm can survive?
What I think is that the debt holders will end up having to swap their debt for equity. And this often happens to companies that are on the verge of basically going out the back door. And so what happens is that the equity might be worth, say, 10, and the debt might be worth, say, 100. And because the debt is 10 times the equity, the company is basically, you know, just a matter of time before it basically trades insolvently. So what the company does is it goes to the debt guys and says, look, we can't afford this ratio of 100 to 10. Could you guys maybe swap 80 of the debt into some equity? So the current equity holders basically get smashed.
Their holding just gets incredibly diluted.
It gets incredibly diluted. And then what happens is that the company sort of what we call recapitalizes. Uh-huh. So I think what happens is that effectively the current equity holders will get smashed. The debt holders will recapitalize the business and you know, it may survive another day.
Okay. All right. Where are we? A 53-year-old has a super preservation age of 58 or 59, by the way, not 60. Tax advantages start at preservation age and enhance at 60. Thank you. Yes, this was in answer to a question earlier. Yes, we had Medibank. Did we buy or sell Medibank shares? Simon has a question in relation to index funds. Hello, Simon.
Yeah, g'day, guys. I'm paying off my house, have no other investments. My question is, if I'm looking at getting into the share market, say borrowing $20,000 or $30,000 and putting in $50 a week, I'm looking at something called an index fund, which just follows the ASX or whatever index you want to invest it in,
yep,
be it Australia and domestically, versus picking some diverse stocks myself and doing it that way. I just caught the tail end of your comment with regards to property versus the share market. My view is, on a long-term basis, maybe an index fund is like a set-and-forget and easy way to do it, for example, like a Vanguard fund.
David?
Well, index funds will simply just go up and down with the market. And as I sort of stated in my introduction, since 1900, we've had something like 14 crashes, if you like. Now, I define as a crash as simply something that's gone down 20 or 25%. But the problem is that of those 14, we've had 5 or 6 or 7 that have gone down 40s or 50s or 60s or in the Great Depression, 85. So your index fund is just going to go up and down exactly with the market. So if you are prepared to go and borrow $30,000 and at any point in time watch that go down to $15,000, that's fine. And as I say, over the very, 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 very long term, on average, you'll probably make a 10% return a year. That's assuming you reinvest your dividends. So my advice to most people is, it seems to me more logical to pay down your house as fast as possible, because you're paying down your house with after-tax money. And you know, to get that risk-free after-tax return of 5%, you actually have to earn, you know, a lot more than that by taking a certain amount of risk. So I just say to people, generally, pay down your house and then worry about investing later.
Yeah, even if the investing later comes, for example, I'm 46, I'm not really going to be able to do it till I'm in my late 50s. I haven't really got the advantage of time. And of course, I can't claim anything on tax while I'm paying off my house.
Okay, well, what I would really encourage you to do, if you're going to go and sort of take a certain amount of risk by borrowing money, even though you still have a mortgage, I'd encourage you to buy when what we call it is blood on the street. And that simply means buy when there's a certain amount of pain around. And you'll know when there's a lot of pain around because the ABC News will be going off and you'll be seeing sort of people walking around that are extremely worried and you'll be seeing the headlines. But buy when there's a certain amount of pain. At the moment, share markets are doing particularly well because interest rates have never been lower. And there's not much pain, and it's much better to buy assets when there's pain rather than when everyone's feeling very good.
Yeah, understood. No, I might look at an apartment at the same time, eh?
I can just tell you that
caution, Sam.
I can just tell you that, you know, most of us invest like lemmings, and we generally buy when things are very good, and we generally sell when things are frightening. And if we can just rearrange our entire behavior, and very, very few people can. But if we can rearrange our entire behaviour and buy when things are very, very sick and sell when things are very, very good, we'll do much better than the averages.
Oh, lovely. Oh, thanks for your advice.
Thanks, yeah. Simon. Good on you. Bye-bye. Yes. Paul says, is it safe to deposit money with Bank or Melbourne or Citibank as opposed to the big four banks? Any view on that?
Yeah, highly likely it is safe.
Hmm. Tracy asked a good question. How do you find a good advisor to advise you anyway on where to invest safely? It's hard, isn't it?
It is hard. I think a good advisor, as much as anything, is a very good cultural fit. So you get on relatively well and you sort of speak the same language. Now, the problem there is so much of it's to do with risk and tolerance to risk. So Philip, you and I might have completely different tolerances to risk. Mm. You know, you might be sort of, let's go and really push the boat out and have a crack. And I might be, oh, no, I've got to pay down my debt tomorrow. So you need people who are going to advise you who are sort of culturally in tune with your thinking mm-hmm. process. Mm-hmm. And also always take a view of they're trying to get you the best after-tax risk-adjusted return. And so that means in your case, you might be prepared to take more risk than me.
Mm. Okay. All right. Jim, hello.
Hello there. Just wondering, I have some money which I've prepaid off for an investment property. So it's quite a large sum. I'm just wondering if it's better for me to take that money out and put it into my self-managed super, which with a possibility of having a fund manager use it, and because of the lower tax on a super, and rely on the negative gearing of that money.
Again, I can't give you specific advice, but that seems to me to be sort of, you know, a logical progression is to sort of get a certain amount of your money into super, because obviously the tax rate there is a lot lower than what would be normally. But again, just going back to the property situation, just ensure that your, you know, property is very, very well covered in terms of the cash flow from the rental stream versus the, you know, versus the interest expense that you're paying on it. And I see a situation at the moment where, you know, a lot of people are sort of, you know, Australian household debt relative to income and GDP is one of the highest in the world. And I see a lot of people that are on the cusp of sort of being in a certain amount of pain if two or three things occur. Number one is if unemployment goes up. Number two, if interest rates go up. Or number three, if property prices fall. I just see that a lot of people are on the sort of verge of pain. And so I just really do encourage a certain amount of conservatism when it comes to indebtedness.
Mm-hmm. I understood. Oh, look, I can easily cover the payments of the property sort of outright if I need to, but it was just one of those things which I thought, well, it's the money sort of sitting there. Basically, I would feel safer with it being in a lower tax environment than what it is currently, that's all.
Mm. Yeah, well, that's the logical progression.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jim. Fred, yep.
Yeah, hello.
Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I've got some IAG shares. Had them ever since the NRMA changed them over to us and everything. And suddenly I got a letter from the IAG. It's established in Melbourne and everything. And they say they owe me $60. Can I send them my BSB number, my account number, my full name and everything? And I thought, why don't they just put it in my... Well, it goes in the Commonwealth Bank. And they just want all my details and everything again on a letter, and I have to send it through the post. Now, I phoned them up and said, oh, this is just our regular thing, what we do, but it's the first time they've ever done it. Now, the thing is, I don't want to send my details through the post. Like, anybody could open it up and know all my details. So I phoned them up, and they said, oh, you know, we just want to transfer $60 that we owe you. Sounded a bit funny to me.
Just be aware, there's a lot of email scams going on with this sort of thing, so just beware of any email scams. If it's via the post and it's got the IAG insignia on the letterhead and things like that, it's probably good to go. But
you rang them, did you, Fred?
I phoned them up.
And they confirmed the letter was theirs?
And they said, oh, you know, we send these things out occasionally. I said, okay. I've never had it before in the whole time I've had all the IAG shares. And I went to the Commonwealth Bank and they said, oh, we can't see anything wrong with it, but we don't know if it's legitimate or not. And they couldn't give me any details because my interest money every year just goes into the Commonwealth Bank. And suddenly they say, we owe you $60. Can you send us all your details? That sounded a bit funny to me.
Yeah, well, Fred, if it's the only way you're going to get your $60 back, I suppose.
I'll throw the $60 in the bin and forget about it.
Yeah. All right, yeah. Fred.
Get them to send you a cheque, Fred.
I told them to do that, and they said they only do it through email, or I don't have an email account.
Say you only accept it through PayPal, through your Swiss bank, Fred. See how they go.
I don't have one of those.
Yes.
No, so you can't advise me whether I should send the letter or forget about it.
I think it's your call.
Your call, Fred. I mean, on balance, just the provision of your bank account number doesn't immediately put you necessarily at any risk.
No, well, if I send you my bank account details and everything, well, you know, it's the same as sending it to anywhere, isn't it? You know?
That's true.
No, you can't help me with it, eh?
I'm afraid not.
Well, I think I'll throw the $60 in the bin.
All right, Fred. All right. Thank you. Bye. 1-300-800-222 is the number. Ben says, how much more downside risk does Telstra have? At $4, I'm tempted to buy more.
Well, it's dividends could be cut because of the three major players in mobile turning into four over the next 2 to 3 years. And, you know, in the early 1980s, there were a lot of very, very high quality stocks that sold at, you know, an 8 or 9% yield. So, you know, I think it could go down potentially another sort of 50 cents very easily if the earnings get smashed.
Okay. All right. More downside on the way, in other words. Joseph called. He wants to know if it's a risk to put all his money in government bonds.
I think it's highly risky putting all your money in government bonds. And the reason is, as I said in my introduction, long bonds, so 10-year bonds around the world in the early 1980s traded at 13, 14, 15 or 16%, depending on which country you're in. And they got down to 0, 1 or 2% depending on which country you're in. When you have a tailwind like that, it's unrepeatable. Mm-hmm. So what's going to happen now, and we've already seen it in Australia, is that bonds in Australia have jumped up from about 1.8% to 2.8%. They've now settled down at closer to 2.5%. But when you sell off from 1.8 to 2.8, they jump by 1% on 1.8, you actually lose a lot of money. And in the States, precisely the same things happen. They went from about 1.35 to about 2.6. They're now back at about 2.35, but again, you lose a lot of money. So bonds are far from riskless when interest rates go up. And I think if we get any inflation in the world, interest rates have the potential to go up somewhat further. They have never been lower as they were in the latter half of last calendar year.
They have to go up. I mean, in a cycle sense, they're on the way up, aren't they?
In a cycle sense, they're on their way up. But we've had
how high will they go?
We've had this wonderful thing called quantitative easing, Philip, particularly in Europe. But one day, the central banks will stop quantitative easing, and the bonds will trade at a market rate, and typically a market rate is inflation plus a couple of percent. Now, if inflation's running at, say, 2 or 3%, they can easily trade at 4 or 5%. And as I say, they're sort of currently half that. Now, if they go from 2.5 to 4 or something like that, then those people that hold bonds are going to get hit very hard.
David, Dennis called and said that he and his partner are ready to buy a house. Should they wait till interest rates go up and buy and house prices come down? What's the best time for us to buy a house? Well, it's the classic question, isn't it? I don't know. But have you got any thoughts on it, David?
I think I'm very nervous about the apartment market, but I'm less nervous about the housing market,
right,
particularly if it's in a half-decent location. Yeah, look, this is very, very complicated because at the moment, I personally think that the governments, both federal and state, have been sort of willfully blind when it comes to foreign buying of Australian property. And I think there's no doubt about it, particularly at the better end of town. The buying from foreigners have certainly sort of help pump up the bubble to a degree that probably shouldn't be there. I think the state governments have been dependent on stamp duty, and the federal government doesn't want the bubble to burst. So, as I say, I think they've been willfully blind. But if the Chinese particularly and the foreign buying ever cools down, I'm pretty sure that property will start to cool at some stage.
Kerry is on the line. Yes, Kerry?
Yes. Hello. I'm just inquiring. I was wondering what effect the between the American and North Korean instability may have on the share market at all. What to do?
So one thing the share market does is it absolutely hates uncertainty. And we saw, for example, when the Brexit vote took place in the last weekend of June last year, the pound had the biggest one-day fall in its history. Mm-hmm. So it hates any uncertainty. So if we end up with an escalation of militarization in the North Korean peninsula, I would suggest that the market will fall very dramatically in a very, very quick time. And we saw this, you know, with past recent wars in the Middle East and the like, where you get this very, very sharp fall. And then what happens is the market sits back and takes stock and says, look, this at the end of the day is an elephant versus a flea, being the Americans versus North Korea. And it even seems that the Chinese have actually become allies to the Americans rather than the North Koreans on this point. And they're obviously talking a diplomatic story. Or a story of diplomacy. But the bottom line is that there'll be probably a very sharp fall. It may last 24 or 48 hours. And then people will take stock and say, the elephant will smash the flea in 5 minutes. And then everything will resume as normal. It would be my guess.
It'll have anything long term. But do you think it's not a good idea to convert your shares into cash or anything? I mean, I'd probably have more of a severe effect on the share market, but you know, you sort of just hate to see all your superannuation all disappear.
Well, that's right, but it's just, the first thing is it's unknowable. The second thing is the degree of any decline is unknowable. The third thing is that the timing of any decline is unknowable. So you're really just throwing darts by sort of jumping at shadows. And as I say, You know, you often get these worries that last just two or three or four days, and then often the market's confidence returns because they get some sort of assessment and says, "Oh, well, it will crush that flea in a very short period of time, and as long as it doesn't escalate, it's when it escalates, it gets quite a worry."
Right. Okay. So you don't think it's a good idea to convert to share to cash at all?
I don't know.
That's all. All right. Okay. I was just thought I'd ask what your opinion was. But thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Kerry. Aaron from Melbourne says, wanted to ask David's opinion of TPG now with the new 4G capacity that they've bought. Is it worth investing?
Well, what I see is a scenario where there was three operators, of which one of them was the merger between Hutch and Vodafone, and we used to have four became three becomes a sort of happy little oligopoly, and every time we go back to four, it becomes quite an unprofitable industry. The industry structure changes, and the industry structure changes because the fourth player needs to effectively buy market share. How does he buy market share? He has to cut his price, he has to bundle up his offerings, and so what happens is that people either lose market share or they have to follow. And, you know, we saw the same thing with OneTel not so long ago. And what ultimately happens is that the industry goes from being sort of, you know, happily profitable at three players to unhappily less profitable with four players. So I think it's one of those situations where it's just better to sit on the sidelines, watch it play out. And if it gets very, very ugly, then maybe the shares might become good buying. But until you have a sense of confidence that the worst is over, and that could be 2 or 3 years away, I think, you know, it's better to be discreet.
Okay. All right. Yes, Doug. We've probably got time for one more. Yes, Doug.
Yeah, good evening. Thanks for taking my call. Been reading some interesting articles online. One, talk of the Americans releasing a new currency called Fedcoin because they've printed so much money they can't back it. There's not enough paper there even to cover it. Also wondering about gold. I'm reading the same thing, that a lot of people think they own gold, but unless they've physically got it in their hand, there's a lot more gold being sold than what actually is in the vaults around the world as well. And with the amount of quantitative easing that the US have put into their market being so high, is there a big crash got to come? Comments on those, if you choose?
Okay.
Okay, so... yeah, gold. I mean, clearly it's better to own the physical than have it in some sort of vault, because you just don't know if you can ever always get your hands on it. So that's stating the obvious. But, you know, you assume if you've got it in a vault of a half decent bank, you'll always be able to get your hands onto it.
Is it worthwhile investing in it?
Don't know.
Okay.
On cash in the Fed, I think the US dollar is the global reserve currency, so I wouldn't get too excited about new currencies there. But I do note that what's happening is, because of the black market, particularly, some countries are kicking out their high denominational notes, and India is a case in point that they're doing that as well. And that's largely to try and attack the black market as much as anything. And then finally, you know, is there a crash coming? Look, there's, you know, I think most economists have predicted, you know, 13 of the last three crashes, and we don't know when they're going to come, but we just know statistically 1 year in four is down, and 1 year in seven or eight are down big, i.e. 20%. And then every one of those three or four are down really big, i.e. 30 or 40 or 50 or 60%. So we don't know. We just know that, you know, they happen with a certain amount of regularity every 7 or 8 years on average. But we just don't know when.
And to keep forecasting a flood, it will come.
Yep. I bet you my bottom dollar, one day it will come.
All right, mate. Thank you for that, David. Doug, sorry, I appreciate the call too. Appreciate everyone who's called tonight too. Sadly, all the good things must come to an end. David Buckland from Montgomery Investment and Management, pleased to see you in. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you for yours.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.